Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are...
Devendra Hardware.
Jeff Cannata.
And joining us today, he is the editor-in-chief of ScreenCrush.com. Congratulations on the recent promotion, sir. Matt Singer, welcome back to the Slash Filmcast. How are you doing, Matt Singer?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Matt, it's been quite a while since we've had you on, and that's not by choice. It's because you have recently had a child, which has limited your time to appear on guests. Which has limited your time to appear as guests on other podcasts. So, firstly, wanted to say congrats on the recent promotion at Screen Crush. That's pretty awesome. How are you feeling now that you run the entire operation?
I am drunk with power. It is fantastic.
I mean, you were already pretty drunk with power before, so...
It's hard not to boss you people around right now, frankly. I'm so used to just telling people to do my bidding. This is uncomfortable for me.
It sounds like it. And also, I'm curious how having a child has changed your perspective on the job, on movies, if at all. Do you feel like time is more precious now that you only have a few waking hours every day? Do you understand Interstellar more? What has the act of becoming a father, like how does that affect, you know, watching movies for you?
That's a good question. You know, I guess I'm still sort of feeling all that out. I'm not really entirely sure yet. There are times where I wonder about that, I guess. But then again, I've seen some movies that, you know, like I watched Inside Out last year before I was a dad, and I cried my eyes out. And I saw Finding Dory this summer as a dad and didn't have much of an emotional reaction to it, to be totally honest with you. So I'm not sure that it's changed the
things. I think that's more of a testament to how much better Inside Out was than Finding Dory. But
that could be.
But I've noticed on some of your tweets and Facebook posts, like, do you notice – sexism in movies more now? Like, it seems like that's part of the case.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I have a daughter, so certainly when men are very upset about women, you know, busting things, ghosts mostly, it does raise my hackles a little bit. You know, I get really excited to read, like, little board books with my daughter about Wonder Woman. For all the dads who are comic book nerds of daughters out there, there's this great board book, like the DC Book of Girl Power, I think it's called, and it has all the different female superheroes. It's really great, and I love reading that. And actually, I was just at a, like, Toys R Us, Babies R Us, buying something for her and walked past an aisle with, like, DC super, I forget what they're called, but it's like a whole line of new superhero figures specifically targeted for girls. Like, you know, it's all female heroes and they're sort of styled differently. And I was like super excited. I almost bought them all, even though they're probably way too, you know, way too age inappropriate for her. She's only 7 months old. They're probably for like 6 year olds. But I was just so excited to see something like that for her that like that kind of stuff gets me excited. So, yeah, I guess that probably has changed. Before her, I was, I'm sure, a very insensitive jerk and didn't care about anyone else, and that does change. Now I care about two people, I guess. So
slightly less insensitive.
I'm slightly less of a jerk now.
Nice.
I'm also having a child relatively short amount of time here. It's getting down to the nitty gritty, and my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, threw the baby shower and themed it around books. And so we got a whole bunch of baby books, like the ones that you're describing. And a couple of the ones, because they know that I, you know, am a genre guy and love Star Wars and stuff, I got a couple of these. I'm sure you guys have seen them. The father and son Vader and Luke books.
Mm-hmm. That
it's like, you know, dad and son stories with Vader and Luke. And I'm like, these are awful. The premise of these books is a spoiler for my child.
I have the one that's Vader and Leia. It's, I think it's called like Vader's Little Princess or something. And it's in a, I think it's by, is it Jeffrey Brown? And it's adorable. And I love it. It's a little advanced for her because each page is like a little inside Star Wars joke, and she's right. Obviously not seen them yet, and so it's a little advanced for her. But we've read that one once or twice. But yeah, reading with her is one of my favorite things. I'm sort of in charge of that most nights, and I really I love doing it, even though she clearly has no idea what's going on. It is exciting to be like, okay, here's a Spider-Man book. Pay very close attention, because this is the most important thing I will ever teach you.
One day you're going to introduce her to the Amazing Spider-Man films, and yes, it's going to blow her mind.
in a bad way.
But also, beyond them just not being able to understand the books right now, the Vader-Luke relationship was not terribly functional. Am I right?
No, I think that's part of the joke, is how bad a dad Vader is. But it's also like, you know, one of the things I look forward to very much with my son is eventually showing him the Star Wars films.
When you cut his hand off someday, and
oh well, that too, despite his face. And I want him to be surprised at that reveal. I think that would be a fun moment. Yeah. But
oh my god, I'm just, my mind is just racing with the future psychoses that your son's going to have about, you know, your spoiler policies, Jeff.
Seriously, yeah. Will you have an unsullied household, Jeff?
Of course. That's the – no son of mine shall be sullied.
I think the problem with Jeff's philosophy is that his anti-trailer, anti-spoiler policy only applies to future films. But with a son now, or at least in the near future, any work of art that's ever been created
– that's true. This could be problematic.
Is now potentially a spoiler, right?
It's true.
You cannot make reference to it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, you know.
It's not. I'm going to become a Unabomber-esque hermit, not for fear of technology, but for love of technology. See,
countdown until Jeff's son is a spoiler guy on YouTube, just like spouting shit, you know, spoiling everything for everyone. That's the way you rebel, right?
Just to be.
He's gonna be one of those guys that screams like Snape killed Dumbledore, people waiting in line at Barnes & Noble for the book or something like that. So, I hope you know
what.
I hope you know this, the seeds you're sowing, Jeff Cannata. Anyway. All right. So, what are we here doing today on the Slash Filmcast?
Apparently, talking about life.
Yeah, this is an early episode. So the bonus is that this episode is coming early, and we're getting this out today. Hopefully, the day that Star Trek Beyond is released. The disadvantage of that is, of course, this episode will probably be shorter than a normal episode, and also there will be no episode next week because this is that episode just moved up a few more days. So all we're going to be doing is discussing Star Trek Beyond today, so let's get to that starting right now.
My dad joined Starfleet because he believed in it. I joined on a dare.
You joined to see if you could live up to him. You spent all this time trying to be your father, and now you're wondering just what it means to be you.
It isn't uncommon, you know. It's easy to get lost. In the vastness of space, there's only yourself, your ship, your crew.
You really want to head back out there, huh?
That was from the trailer of Star Trek Beyond, the newest film in the Star Trek franchise. It was directed by Justin Lin this time around and written by Simon Pegg and Doug Jung. It stars all the Star Trek people that we know and love from this newest franchise: Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Carl Urban, Zoe Saldana, Simon Pegg, John Cho, and Anton Yelchin, rest in peace, as well as Idris Elba and Sophia Boutella. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. The USS Enterprise crew explores the furthest reaches of uncharted space, where they encounter a new ruthless enemy who puts them and everything the Federation stands for to the test. So I want to talk about the plot of this movie and certain things that happen in this movie, and I think I'm just going to say that in the pre-spoiler section, can we talk about everything that happens in the trailers? Like, you see some pretty major plot points in the trailers, and I feel like it's going to be difficult to talk about the movie without mentioning those plot points. So if you don't want to be spoiled on what's in the trailers, then just wait until you've seen the film before you listen to this review. But I will talk about trailer developments in the pre-spoiler section. Matt Singer, I consider you a nerd's nerd. Are you a Star Trek fan? Like, what have been your favorite series up until now, or favorite films? And what were you hoping and expecting from this film, and did it deliver?
I would say I'm a moderate to heavy Star Trek fan. I have seen all the movies. I watched a fair amount of Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, the original series, Voyager. I never watched Enterprise, but I've seen a lot of just about all the other shows, liked a lot of them.
Yeah, so you spent hundreds of hours watching Star Trek.
I'd say maybe more than 100, into right. the dozens, definitely. I don't know about hundreds and hundreds. I haven't seen every episode of any of those shows.
Gotcha.
But I've seen a lot of all of them.
Yeah.
And I had a brief, like, year, 2 year period where I was very into Star Trek, like in high school, and went to a convention. And so I know the universe very well. I know these characters very well. I did like the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie a lot, and I didn't particularly care for the last one.
Yeah. Yeah. So what were you hoping from this movie? Did you hope that it would, you know, bring it back to the kind of classical Star Trek that we know and love? Or were you just hoping for more whiz-bang action?
I wouldn't say that I had any sort of specific hopes for it other than I just hoped to like it, you know, that I hoped it was more like the first of the Abrams Trek movies than the second one.
Right, right.
That would have really been it, just that it wouldn't be quite so dour and sullen and gloomy and, you know, you knew already it wasn't going to have all the rigmarole about the who is Benedict Cumberbatch playing and why are they making such a big deal out of his identity. So that was already like a huge leg up for this movie in my eyes, because all of that stuff was just such a colossal waste of time, both in the movie and outside of the movie.
Right. And so what did you think of Star Trek Beyond?
You know, I liked it a lot. I liked it probably more than I expected to. And I felt like in hindsight, I was like, oh, of course I like this movie a lot, because it's directed by Justin Lin, who's made the Fast and the Furious movies, a franchise that I really, really like. And it's co-written by Simon Pegg, who has starred in and co-written, you know, some of my favorite recent movies that he made with Edgar Wright. And, you know, this really kind of reminded me a lot of those movies in particular, actually of both. It has a lot of the flavor of Fast and the Furious in terms of it has big action, but it also is about this family. They don't call themselves a family like they do in Fast and the Furious, but this group of characters, this disparate, diverse group of characters working together for a goal, and all very likable. We like all these people and love watching them work together. And then from like the Simon Pegg side, and I feel like in retrospect, maybe I need to give him more credit for how great those movies are. Not that I didn't before, but just the idea that he makes these movies that are very sort of – they're slick on the surface. They're fun. They're entertaining. But beneath the surface, they're all communicating these ideas, whatever they are. And in this case, it's all of this stuff. As fun and as poppy as this movie is, it's also pretty political. It's – to me, it's so much about what's going on. You know, it very much applies to everything going on in our country. But, you know, for Simon Pegg, a British guy, it probably – feels to him like it's very much a movie about the Brexit and all of that. I feel like it's all sort of working very successfully under the surface of the action and the characters. I'm sure we're going to discuss problems with it. There are a few things I didn't really care for about it that we can talk about, but overall, I like this movie a lot.
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised at your review, Matt. You were very positive on it. No, because I saw the film and I was not as big of a fan. I'll talk about my opinion in a few moments, but Jeff Cannata, let's get to you. What did you think of Star Trek Beyond?
Yeah, you know, I don't disagree with much of what you said there, Matt. I think it is a well-crafted big action sci-fi film. And I give it a lot of credit for that. I think crafting well a big action sci-fi film is not easy. And this movie delivers on really grandiose moments, really intense, awesome action. Everything holds together. Nothing dumb happens. Really great character moments, especially character of Bones, you know, Dr. McCoy. He gets a lot of really fun screen time here. Everybody sort of has something to do, even if it sort of none of it really matters in the end. But I came away from this movie very disappointed that this is where Star Trek is. And I keep saying, if you like, if you think Star Trek should be about punching stuff, then then this is a great Star Trek movie. I think it probably, if all you want to do when you go to the theater is see some really fun action with some fun characters in a cool setting, then this movie's for you. But I feel like we have that, right? This is kind of the same thing I said when Into the Darkness came out. We have a Star War. We got Star War. You know, when JJ rebooted the Star Trek movies, it's because we weren't getting Star Wars on the screen. And he was like, oh, we can have a Star War with the Star Trek. But I don't need a Star War anymore. We don't need another Fast and the Furious on the screen in a different setting. What we don't have, and I think would be really great to have, is the Star Trek that I really love, which is the more, you know, thought-provoking Star Trek. The more let's attempt to avoid violence and conflict if we can. Let's do everything in our power to think through this problem rather than punching it in the nose. And I mean, from the very first moment that there is a threat in this movie, without knowing what it is at all, Kirk is like, attack it! Let's kill it with fire! You know, I know that that's going to – for a lot of the commenters on our site, that's going to sound like the same criticism I leveled at Batman v Superman and okay, whatever. But Star Trek, you know, for me, I was never the original series guy. And I know a lot of people are heralding this as a return to the original series aesthetic where, you know, we're having a away team and adventure happens down on the planet. But – The Star Trek that made me fall in love with the series is The Next Generation, and it is beloved to me. And I loved the way that that show was about thinking at the problem and outsmarting the problem. And yeah, I mean, there was action moments in those series and in those movies, those Next Generation movies, which some of them good, some of them not so good. But I wish, especially where this movie ends up at the end, sort of thematically, it evokes themes that should have, in the first part of the movie, caused our heroes to attempt to not be violent, to attempt to address these situations with some diplomacy and thinking.
I guess we don't want to spoil it, but like, what would you have them do diplomatically when they're under assault from thousands of these tiny ships that are literally pulling the ship apart piece by piece?
I'm not criticizing the approach from the character's perspective. I'm criticizing the approach from the screenwriter's perspective. Right? All they are interested in doing is creating a situation where we're at war, right? The only thing the movie makers are concerned about is let's throw a really nasty enemy, destroy a ship really fast, create a conflict that is warlike, and let's throw our characters into this action beat. And that's fine. And I think, as I said, it works really well for that kind of movie. I just wish I wasn't inside that kind of movie when it has Star Trek on the title.
See, I actually completely disagree with this because I feel like the whole point of this movie is talking about what's going on right now in our world. And the villain, which I won't spoil anything at this point, it all ties into these ideas. And the fact that his point of view differs so strongly from the characters that he attacks, who, yes, respond with action and violence because they are attacked. And there's plenty of points in this movie where they have like borderline philosophical discussions about their different views of the world. And yes, there is a lot of action in the movie, but I honestly feel like this movie, and it is more like the original series, The Next Generation. I certainly agree with that. It is a movie with the characters from the original series. But I do feel like this movie has more of kind of that Gene Roddenberry sort of naive optimism in a bold, bright future than certainly the previous two J.J. Abrams movies have, and even a lot of the Next Generation's movies had, and most Star Trek content in the last like 10, 20 years. Like, I feel like this, although it is more, you know, action-oriented, I feel like the spirit of classic Star Trek really is in this movie.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like we're not going to be able to have a super productive conversation until we get to spoilers. So let's just do some quick impressions from Devendra and I. Devendra, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I really enjoyed this film, too. I think I'm pretty much right there with you, Matt. We got to sit together for this screening, and hearing Matt respond with, like, childlike glee whenever anything cool happened, that's kind of just how I was feeling. This movie is a ton of fun. It does feel more like the original series, and, I'll be honest, I'm not much of a Star Trek guy, but those are the ones that have been kind of ingrained in me since childhood. You know, the idea of big space adventures, charting the unknown, dealing with unknown threats, things like that. And I like Next Generation. My wife loves it. It's probably her favorite, you know, piece of media ever. But it's not something I was ever able to get into because it always seemed a little too, I don't know, staid, a little too like everything. Yeah, well, not even cerebral. It's just like everything's chill. We kind of don't have much conflict. Let's talk for a while. And oh yeah, the Borg appears, so that's bad. But I think like the idea of like this timeline, or at least in the original series, right? They didn't have so much of the galaxy charted. They didn't know as much about what was going on out there. And I think this movie kind of reflects that too. This is a movie of discovery, and of charting the unknown in really dangerous ways. At the same time, I do wish it was probably about more than it actually is. There's a little bit of Kirk character building here, some great work with the whole team, but I don't think it's about any major big ideas. It does feel smarter than your typical summer blockbuster, though.
Matt Singer is going to prove you wrong in the spoiler section, guys. I believe it. I'll just share some quick thoughts. I kind of side with Jeff on this. I think it was a fun film, but Star Trek for me, from Next Generation, used to be about big ideas. And the issue with this film, I think, is that there is nothing that distinguishes the Federation or the Starship Enterprise from a military organization. And in many ways, it has military elements to it, the Federation does. But the Starship Enterprise could have just been some military ship. And the themes that they're espousing about teamwork, that could just be like a military idea. There's nothing about desiring a better future for the universe and for all peoples in a way that I found was so compelling in things like The Next Generation.
What does the timeline work, by the way? Because you Star Trek nerds know when they were demilitarized. Do you have a sense of like how far away that was from when this movie started?
Well, I think this movie starts at the third year of the 5-year mission of the original Star Trek, which is like basically where the original Star Trek original series left off, if I'm not mistaken. Like,
mm-hmm. But when did like the Federation demilitarize?
He's talking more about like the history of the Federation.
I'm not, like I said,
I haven't seen Enterprise. I'm not a huge expert, but they mentioned that at one point, this is kind of tiptoeing around spoilers, but basically there's like a information that's given that something has happened like well over 100 years ago, and that thing that has happened, it would have taken place shortly after the creation of the Federation,
right.
I believe.
Yeah.
So we're maybe 100 to 200 years into the Federation.
Okay. Yeah. So I will say things that I liked about the film. Firstly, some of the action sequences are quite good, and visually it continues the trend of what J.J. Abrams created with Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness. Whether that's a good thing or not is up to you. Like, if you like those films, this movie looks indistinguishable from them. Like, from
there's a lot of Justin Lin in here, though. I think like very, very like specific shots of like a certain angle.
And a lot of hand-to-hand combat that I didn't think was shot particularly well, Justin Lin has a lot of hand-to-hand combat in his films. And I thought it was, pretty thrilling in this movie. But visually it looks very much the same. And not only does it visually look the same, like one thing that J.J. Abrams did in his films was he had this his camera was very free-floating. Like it would go like upside down and like twirl around and there'd be lens flares. And it's almost like they took that aesthetic and created a city in this movie based off of that aesthetic. Because there is a space station called Yorktown in this film that is like an M.C. Escher drawing brought to life in a Star Trek film, which I thought was visually interesting. I don't know if architecturally it makes much sense, but
I don't think it does either, but it's really cool.
It looked really cool. And so, but I think that if you're not going to bring the big ideas like Jeff and I are looking for, then the action has to be really, really good. And I would give it a B, B plus maybe. You know, like it wasn't, there wasn't enough of it for me to really feel like that was enough to sustain this film. If you look at Star Trek I, the J.J. Abrams film, like that movie moves. There, you are never bored in that film. And this movie doesn't quite live up to that level of engagement, in my opinion. So overall, I enjoyed it. But I, like Jeff, was also hoping maybe this one would show us a little bit more than just a lot of action and special effects. And I didn't think it did. And I didn't think the action was transcendent enough to make it a great film, in my opinion. So those are my thoughts. Anything else we want to mention pre-spoilers? I do want to give a shout-out to the soundtrack. Michael Giacchino doing a great job again. And I'm a big
fan. It is really funny what Matt was saying. This is so funny. They give Bone so much. They give Scotty so much. And like they really tap into like Carl Urban's sort of whininess, which you don't – you look at a guy like that, right? Oh, he's a beautiful, strong man. Let's make him a hero of some kind. But he can be really funny too, and the script really taps into that.
Yeah, I think the cast continues to be great. And that's one of the things that has propelled these movies to now. Like it's probably the one thing that kept me going through Star Trek Into Darkness is the cast is so likable and so charismatic, and they have such great chemistry together. I would continue to watch their adventures together until the franchise, you know, drove this into the ground. But I think the performances are great, and I love the cast. So
and Sophia Boutella as the like new alien friend is a lot of fun to watch. I really liked her in Kingsman, and she pretty much kicks ass.
Yeah, she brings a lot of great physicality to that role. For sure. Any other thoughts, or shall we move into spoilers? Let's get to spoilers for Star Trek Beyond, starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
Can I see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it, because of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
All right, Matt Singer. Tell us, what is this movie about, in your opinion?
I mean, it all is about, like I said earlier, like it seems to me to be a very not too thinly veiled allegory for modern politics of fear.
So basically, Krall is Trump, I think is what you're saying.
I wouldn't say Krall is Trump. I would say Krall would have been a Trump supporter. Like not to be too blunt about it, but his politics are the politics that I just watched Trump talk about in his speech yesterday. Like it's kind of amazing that this movie is coming out the week of the Republican National Convention. The timing could not be more perfect. It's either like an accident of magic or it's like next level trolling on the part of Star Trek and being like putting forth almost the exact opposite ideology.
Right. He is sort of Ed Harris in The Rock for me.
The problem is that there's there's no Bernie perspective in the movie. Everyone's a hawk in this film. And that's kind of the problem we have now, too. What bothers me is, like Dave was saying, there really aren't big ideas. You know, you have this captain's log at the beginning where Kirk is basically saying, everything feels episodic. I'm so bored by all this searching the galaxy stuff. Ugh, I wish I could punch stuff. And then his dream comes true, and a guy arrives that he can punch. And that guy is like, oh, I'm so pissed. I've been so pissed that I haven't been able to punch anything for so long. And now I somehow garnered an army, which we don't get any explanation for about how that all happened. Like somehow he created this awesome tiny ship army.
That's his crew, isn't it?
Is it that many
survivors of the crew?
I would assume at least like his second in command is like one of his survivors.
Because he talks about discovering this alien race, right? Doesn't he mention that?
He discovers the remnants of their technology.
Oh, the alien technology. Gotcha.
The way he looks is because he absorbed a bunch of aliens'
correct
energies somehow.
Putting that aside,
he's so angry because we stopped being a military galaxy, and Kirk kind of feels the same way. And
Kirk doesn't feel that way at all, but okay.
Well, Kirk is so bored.
Yeah,
so
I mean, he is bored, and the one thing that makes him not be bored at the end is that he went through this almost life-destroying adventure.
The problem is
but he saved people's lives. It's not like he was going around willy-nilly killing people. He saved thousands.
But wouldn't
of
it be great if like visiting planets and discovering the galaxy was as valued to Kirk as you know the stuff that he does in this movie? Wouldn't that be cool? I feel like there is no point at which he proposes there is no philosophical discussion, despite their sort of punchy verbal sparring at the end, where Kirk is espousing, hey, maybe we shouldn't be a military world. Like there's no hey, this guy, all this guy wants to do is fight. He is a former military guy who feels out of place in the galaxy now. All he wants to do is fight. Let's maybe not give him exactly what he wants. You know, there's no philosophical point of view from that side, you know?
Okay, fine. But, I mean, they don't even beat him with guns. They beat him, like, as goofy as the ending is, as goofy as the thing is with the Beastie Boys, they literally beat him with speech, with you know, speaking. They beat him with a voice.
Progressive values of the Beastie Boys.
There are numerous action sequences where we just have phaser shooting. Like a crew goes onto a ship and we just shoot them dead.
They have boarded their ship and they're attacking
them. Yeah, they're being defensive. Yeah, come on.
Like, I'm not a violent person. I've never been in a fight in my life. But like it's an action movie. It's a blockbuster. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why
you're so mad. If aliens step on you, you're going to step right back.
That they defend themselves with phasers. Like,
I keep saying, you keep defending the actions of the characters from the characters' perspective. And I have no problems with that. I'm talking about why write them into that position. If I understand writing characters into that position if you're making a big popcorn action film. And that's great. And I will repeat, as a big popcorn action film, this movie works really, really well. It's very well executed. Those scenes are fun and kinetic, and that big moment where they're boarding their ship and taking them down, it's all cool. I am criticizing the filmmakers of a Star Trek movie because I feel like we don't need another movie where the big bad guys board the ship and destroy the Enterprise and it goes down in a fiery mess onto this. I feel like that's redundant.
I wanted to say two things. One thing is, if you want that kind of Star Trek, there are literally hundreds of hours of television and several movies. I just rewatched the first Star Trek, the motion picture, which I actually like and is sort of a very beautiful movie about exploration, discovery, what life would be like on a starship. That it has no action whatsoever. The biggest action sequence in that movie literally slows the movie down because everyone starts moving in slow motion because they're trapped in a wormhole or something. That's fantastic. I like that movie. I defended it on the Star Trek podcast a few weeks ago, and I wrote this big piece about it. It exists. Like, Star Trek isn't just this one thing. That's kind of one of the beauties of Star Trek is that it has all these different things in it.
But
and
you
it
and
can
I
be
are making,
so many you, different things.
You and I
it doesn't
are making
have
the same,
to just be the Next Generation. There's a new Matt. TV show coming out in January. Like, who knows
you
what
that will You and I are making the same point. My point is there are hundreds and hundreds of hours of the big action-y sci-fi movie. When I go to the movies now, I don't have the choice of seeing genre filmmaking that – is a little more about big ideas. Like that,
I don't know if that's so true anymore, though.
Yeah, I don't.
Like,
there's a lot of
you have people like Christopher Nolan working. Yeah, well, look at Interstellar, right? For me, Interstellar is like a great encapsulation. It's like as much as like goofy as some of that movie is, that is a great encapsulation of like exploration Star Trek. You know, charting to the unknown, seeing the wonder of being somewhere new. And then you have lower budget things like Ex Machina. And maybe at some point we'll have like maybe lower budget sci-fi Star Trek films. But I'm actually really interested in seeing what Brian Fuller does with it, too, because that guy is a thinker and he will definitely deliver the like, you know, very
definitely
philosophical
excited.
Star I mean, Trek that you want. Yeah.
I would also say I've been going to the, you know, even though I am a dad, like I've seen most most of the big movies this summer, and most of them are pretty crappy. Like, it's not that easy to make a movie this entertaining. Like, to me,
I agree.
This is
I
one
said
of
that
the
too.
Very best blockbusters we've gotten this summer. Like, it is doing this is not so simple. And you say that there's a lot of options in terms of like dumb big action movies, and that's true, but there isn't a lot of options in terms of actually kind of smart big action movies that are very entertaining and successful. At least this year there haven't been a lot, so to me this movie is refreshing.
Well, I did say that in my review, that this is not easy, and I respect it. I think it's a great movie if that's what you're looking for from a Star Trek. I really do think it's a good movie. I am chagrined at the fact that this is where Star Trek is, and that's my personal taste, and that's all I can speak from.
Jeff,
but I also will say there are several moments, as smart as the movie is most of the time, there are several moments where I put my head in my hands, including when the movie was completely sabotaged. You know, that moment, I don't know how anybody could like that moment.
Okay. Well, firstly, Jeff, I want to quote from one of our famous philosophers in American culture and say that don't hate the player, hate the game. And what I mean by that is the type of movie you're talking about, you know, like think of how Star Trek First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis did. I mean, Nemesis was just a bad film. But, you know, Insurrection, I would argue, did have some of the moral complexity of the Next Generation. That movie made $70 million at the box office. Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams film, and Star Trek in the Darkness made over $200. So I just don't know that people are looking for that kind of film. And I think it's like market forces are dictating what Star Trek movies are being made like these days. You know, like
fair enough. I think many more people are going to enjoy this movie perhaps than the movie that I would like to see from Star Trek, but that's okay. I can still speak from what I would like, and the fact that as a fan of this IP, I can go to this movie and be disappointed that it's just a big dumb action movie.
Right. Well, let's talk about the dumb parts of this movie. Firstly, I will say this is not dumb. Here is my personal bias showing through. I don't know how I feel about the fact that we've seen three Star Trek films in this new franchise, and every Star Trek film feels the need to just rip the shit out of the Starship Enterprise. Like, the Starship Enterprise is one of the best designed starships, I would say, you know, in the history of sci-fi. Like, it is an iconic design that inspires awe and wonder. And every single film has just torn this ship to shreds in a way that is almost pornographic, in my opinion. Like, you just have this starship, it's so beautiful, and then they just rip this thing apart and
cry every time that happens.
You don't care about the dozens of crew members we see get sucked into the vacuum of space. But the fact that the beautiful ship gets broken, you're a little...
I will say that miffs me a little too, Matt Singer. I mean, okay. It does kind of bother me a little too that a lot of the crew is just treated disposably and are dispatched and or tortured in horrifying ways in this film.
Very much keeping with the classic Star Trek ethos, but continue.
Yeah. No, fair enough. But yeah, I don't like how they rip – each filmmaker seems to take some kind of perverse joy in just tearing this ship apart. And – This movie is like the ne plus ultra of that idea. Like, I mean, firstly, the design of Krall's ships is so cool. I mean, just the ships, and it's also kind of like the end of Ender's Game, if you've seen that film. Like, just the hive, the way that the hive, like, acts on the ship, and the way, like, they can just board the ship easily by, like, penetrating it is...
His introduction, by the way, with that, just like, I'm going to fucking dock you. And, I'm the big bad villain. That was pretty great.
I will say one thing that I do like in terms of in relation to the ship itself is I feel like these new films give a real sense of the geography of the ship in a way that the original series couldn't, just because the technology was not there.
Or even Next Generation or any of the TV
series, just like,
really.
You know, you could tell, like, in the original series, Next Generation, it's just like a model, right? Mm-hmm. It's a model or a miniature, or it's created in a computer. This one, it actually feels like a ship because you have a camera that goes from, like, one window of the bridge, and then it, like, drifts around down and you see like another window where another crew member is running for their life, you know? And that part that I think this new franchise really added, I think is pretty cool.
And as, you know, Dave, as much as you love the design of the Enterprise, like I think Justin Lin takes the very logical approach of how you would destroy that thing, because there's like a big freaking weak point on that ship that everybody, all the villains just seem to ignore.
Great.
Yeah. You mean like, the fact that like that firstly they dismantle the ship like systematically. First they rip off the warp nacelles, and then I think you're saying the saucer connected
to the saucer versus the base part. Whatever.
Yeah, the hull, right?
Other reason I kind of thought this was these new movies have been quite punishing to the poor Starship Enterprise. I like the fact that in this one, you know, like each of the movies so far have kind of had these like homages back to the previous ones. And like the second one, it went way overboard with the Wrath of Khan stuff. Mm-hmm. But this one, you know, it kind of nods back to Star Trek III, which also destroyed the Enterprise and waylaid the crew on this distant planet where they had to sort of fend for survival. They essentially remade it without remaking it. They had a totally different plot. It didn't involve Spock dying, any of that, but they did sort of use that central set piece, the destruction of the Enterprise, which I thought
it actually did involve Spock dying, Matt Singer. But anyway,
this movie. Oh, yeah. I suppose yes. I suppose
same
you're
Spock.
Right. You're right. It's in a way, Spock. It's a clever nod to that too. I suppose I didn't think of it that way, but yeah, you're right with Ambassador Spock.
So, I
like that.
Let's talk about some of the dumb things in this film. Firstly, the idea that they're being sent on this. Oh, hey, let's just take this random ass scientist's word that we need to go save them by sending our flagship spaceship into this incredibly dangerous nebula where they can't be helped by anyone. Mm-hmm. And nothing bad will happen to them.
What would you propose as an alternative?
I don't know. Like maybe send like a pro.
Here's why I like that. Yeah. Because in contrast to what we've been saying here, like they could, you know, this stranger who they can't even communicate with until they hook her up with the universal translator in a way that I thought was super cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
You know, they could have thrown her in jail. They could have, you know, they could have deported her, so to speak. Instead, they actually listen to her and care about her concerns and treat her as an equal, as a human being or a alien being, I guess. But an equal with needs, and like they trust her. Like there's something, again, naive about it, and maybe there's something naive about all of Star Trek and all the ideals that they're espousing. But I like that. I like the fact that they believed her and trusted her, and perhaps that was foolish, and they went off.
There's no perhaps about it, Matt. She betrayed them for sure. I mean,
you were talking after the fact, Dave, as if you were a genius Star Trek, you know, commander.
But again, that is an example where they could have acted violently and destroyed her or locked her away.
Right.
Sent her to space Gitmo, whatever it is. They didn't do that.
I appreciate the idealism here. Like don't see that enough in movies. And it turns around and bites them in the ass.
Okay, but didn't the idealism kind of lead a lot of the crew to be killed and others to be tortured? I mean, I'm saying saying the movie takes a position on how we should treat quote unquote aliens. You know, like isn't one of the messages that, hey, if the Enterprise had just stuck to their own business, none of these horrible things would have happened?
I don't think that's the message. That's maybe your takeaway.
Isn't it possible to extrapolate that? That's all I'm saying. Like, I feel like it kind of is. I mean, they brought all this horror upon themselves by being kind to this person.
I guess we should just dismantle NASA and never go to outer space. That is the message.
I am not advocating against that.
I don't think that's the analogy that you were making. I think the analogy you were making was we shouldn't let the foreign person onto our ship, if you get my meaning.
Yeah, if they just hadn't done that, then none of these horrible things would have happened. That being said, Matt, I did find it to be a somewhat compelling argument that you made in your review. Very well-written review. I'm just saying I don't necessarily agree with it. That the Krall represented kind of warlike, hawkish, isolationist, nationalistic tendencies that the Federation is fighting against, right?
He absolutely does. Yeah. I mean, and I think – and while the movie was going on, I didn't think Krall was dumb. I wouldn't put that as a dumb thing, but I would definitely say he wasn't all that interesting to me as he's first introduced. He seems like a very generic – plucked from a, made in a factory bad guy, right? He just hates everything. He wants to destroy everything. He's this creepy looking alien dude, but also kind of generic looking. And he espouses these beliefs that what, like, struggle is strength, and I come from a planet where war made us strong, and everything like that.
Yeah, he's like the bane of the Star Trek world. Yeah.
But he was talking about Earth.
Right, that's the thing, is when they reveal, and maybe you guys figured it out way in advance, I didn't really see it coming, and I thought when they reveal that he is one of us, I think it puts everything he said to me in a whole new light, because he's not just talking about this imaginary world of evil, he's talking about our planet and our society.
Wouldn't it be cool if right at that moment when we realize, which by the way, I thought was a very dumb moment when she sees Idris Elba and she's like, I know that actor.
It was really badly edited, that whole discovery scene. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't crazy about that.
But I feel like it could have been so cool if right at that moment we realized, oh my God, all this guy wants to do is fight. Let's battle that with not fight. Let's battle that with peace. Let's attack. Let's undermine his very desire to wage war. I thought that I was waiting for the movie to bring me into that kind of big idea place, and I don't know. It felt like a missed opportunity.
Which they do by sabotaging, both literally and figuratively, his hive mind technology, and then using the song to, you know, defeat his fleet rather than blowing them up with guns or the photon torpedo.
It's actually a pretty nonviolent big finale as far as, you know, these things go.
Well, it's not nonviolent in terms of deaths, but yes, I
Well,
I
alien lives
it was not
don't
used...
matter, Dave.
You've already established that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's methodology to destroy. It's not. There's no big idea on display. Let's play the Beastie Boys and blow them all up.
Yeah, but Jeff, you're asking for like different approaches to like rather than just blowing shit up or punching shit or shooting things. And I think that whole Beastie Boys thing, even though it was built up, they really, really built that up because you knew what was coming. And it was really only a matter of like which song they'd play. But to me, that was such like an ingenious way of going the other way. It is sort of like peace is solving this whole thing. It's the idea of music and art and progressive ideals and unity that has really destroyed these aliens.
I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I will say that I think this ending with the sabotage, it fits in with a lot of other Star Trek properties and films. Like I remember in Star Trek VI, you know, when they did some surgery on a photon torpedo to defeat the enemy in that film. You know, like, there's just a bunch of, like, random technology hacks that they just use to defeat the enemy. And so it kind of fits in with a lot of
Even know if the other movies have to justify it. I think in the universe that this movie gives us, it sets it all up, and it kind of pays off pretty well. But also, like, I'm looking at the movie in terms of, like, what it's giving me. And is the movie, you know, accomplishing the goals it sets out to do? And I think it really does. It's tougher when we want to, like, say, like, I want to do something very different in the film.
Playing the Beastie Boys didn't bother you?
No.
I like,
but also that was how we were introduced to this entire universe. That's the very first scene of the first Star Trek.
Also, I gotta say, like, visually, I thought that scene was beautiful. Like that was the only scene in the movie where I thought to myself, "Wow!" Like, I was finally filled with the kind of wonder that I was looking for. Just the image of this freaking starship surfing this wave of hive ships exploding all in sequence. It's just a very striking visual, and I enjoyed it on that level. That being said,
the fact that it's this, you know, this is like the Simon Pegg thing, the little touches again. The fact that it's a hive mind and they move with basically one person telling them what to do, you know, that there's this dictator at the top of the chain versus the Enterprise, where the final, you know, this creative idea that they come up with to defeat the bad guy. Literally, if you watch the way they shoot it and edit it, every single person on the crew, in the main crew anyway, has like a key role to play in figuring it out. Now, it's all technobabble BS, but it reinforces the idea of what Uhura says to Krall at one point in the movie, this idea that they're strong because they're together, because they're this diverse group versus these these aliens who all, you know, look alike. They wear these dehumanizing or de-alienizing identical space armor uniforms. They have no individuality. They move as one. They attack as one. And that represents his whole ethos of war and how, you know, that, like, that's the way to do things. And it does, to me, present a very clear juxtaposition between him and the Enterprise and the Federation. And I thought all of that was really cleverly done. And it, to me, that felt very much like Simon Pegg and the way that he threads those kind of little touches into movies like Shaun of the Dead or World's End, where all those little things always – they're there, but they also tend to pay off in some way.
I'll back off. I think I'm coming across much more negative than I intend to. I think the movie is fun, and I think it's, as I've said over and over, I think it's extremely well crafted. I just don't think it's special, and I wish Star Trek movies felt special. And when he says this movie is I'm feeling episodic at the beginning, I really felt like this felt like an episode, a long extended episode. And I think that's what a lot of people like about it. For me, it just didn't feel special.
Where I disagree with you, Matt Singer, about the Krall character, I guess I just feel like I needed a little bit more. The movie felt like it was too focused on action scenes and set pieces. And by the way, another impressive set piece I want to say is the fight inside the downed saucer of the Enterprise, where it's kind of like Inception style. I think even before that, like where the ship is kind of turning around and the gravity's going everywhere, I thought was pretty impressive. But anyway, going back to my point, I guess I wish the movie had given me a little bit more character development on Krall, or separate from that, you know, the Kirk Spock stuff. Kirk and Spock are both dealing with some heady things, and it feels like it's dispatched very quickly as a formality. Like, oh, Kirk's feeling bored, and then he has this adventure, and then now he's not feeling bored anymore. Spock has this kind of survivor's guilt from his whole planet getting destroyed, and hey, maybe he's going to still have adventures with Kirk. Like, it feels too thin. You know, I wish more time had been devoted to building those characters and their relationships so that when the payoff finally comes, it would feel like an emotional catharsis versus just like, here's just some random stuff that happens to Kirk and Spock, and oh, here's some random twist with Krall, which is what it felt like to me.
I would have liked to spend more time with those two together. There's that great elevator scene where they're just dudes who can't, like, talk about their emotions, which I thought was just really funny. It's weird that the movie teams them up with the other characters rather than having Kirk and Spock kind of deal with this thing on their own at one point.
I think the movie teams Spock with Bones because they are so different, and the movie is you know, again, like people of difference coming together to work together to have complementary skills. We already saw Kirk and Spock kind of go through that in the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, and it worked really well there. But now they sort of, even though they have trouble like expressing their love for one another, which is sort of classic going all the way back to the original series, like they clearly have a much stronger relationship. I totally do, though, agree. I would have loved to have seen more of the characters, and in general, I do think some of that stuff must have been either cut in the editing room or just in the writing process to make it a little more sort of fluid and to make it more action oriented. There are some nice character moments though in the movie. I love the stuff in the beginning with Kirk. I love the scene with him and Bones drinking, and Bones asks him, "You gonna call your mom?" Which is like, when does anyone in Star Trek ever say like, "Are you gonna call your mom on your birthday?" Which is also the day his dad died. Like, just that was like a moment where you're like, "Oh yeah, these are like they feel like real people and not just these iconic characters who are now 50 years old." In terms of Krall and his, you know, lack of development or whatever, like the fact that you don't really – they're withholding the information so they can play the twist on you. And it is in a way I think a little frustrating in terms of you don't really get to know him all that well. But I think the way that it works in the context of the movie is – in a way, I think the movie kind of wants you to dismiss him as generic the way that I did. Like, it wants you to kind of say this guy is just he's just like a, you know, like a generic evil bad guy. So that when you actually don't take him all that seriously. So that when the movie does the twist and surprises you, it sort of forces you to reassess, like, oh, maybe these people that I assume are pure evil, maybe they're not that different from me that I thought.
They're
like,
just
even the
like
fact,
us.
Yeah, even the fact that he looks, you know, like that at the end of the movie, he looks human, and it reinforces the idea that beneath whatever the exterior is, we all, in the end, are kind of the same. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of, like, that to me, that really hit home. Like, I thought that was kind of powerful.
And we didn't get much time with Krall and his backstory, but the little that's there is pretty compelling, right? A decorated military guy who, you know, has done all this stuff. And what happens is, like, the war is over. There's no fight left for him. He's, you know, set on a job he doesn't want, and his crew is mostly killed. I think he mentions that, too. And nobody comes to help him. So I think, like, this idea of just, like, this resentment building up over, you know, decades, 100 years plus, that's kind of interesting to see, too.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, Matt, and I think if we had gotten some more, even just a little bit more backstory on the, not Krall, but who he was before, I think that moment would have had more impact for me. Mm-hmm. Just because you need to give a significant amount of info on one of those characters, i.e., you know, pre-Krall Idris Elba or post-Krall Idris Elba. And if you're not going to do one, I feel like you need to do the other for that reveal to have its desired effect. But hearing you talk about the movie, Matt, is definitely making me appreciate it a lot more. So appreciate all the positive things you have to say about it. Any closing thoughts on this film? Did we think the ending – I thought the ending – like we talked earlier about how other Star Trek films have had convenient contrivances, let's say. Like, oh in this movie, hey, if we play music really loud, they'll all die, you know, or like other movies have had stuff like that, right? But this movie had, I feel, a few too many of those. Just like at the end, there was just a huge sequence of, he's about to release the bioweapon in this one space, but there just happens to be a way to flush that area out into the void, you know? Like just a few too many of those, like, hey, this is super
is that
convenient
really
technology.
Convenient, though? I mean, I don't know. Like, think about the way for me, that sort of stuff makes sense in the logic of the movie, right? If this is your atmosphere system, the thing that spreads air all over the entire spaceship, it doesn't seem that much of a stretch to be like, oh, by the way, there is a way to vent things if, like, it's contaminated or something like that.
The fact that it was
the
like
music
a, gravity,
is more convenient.
Wacky gravity area was convenient
the gravity
for the
stream.
Purposes of an action sequence. I would certainly see that.
Although I like the way that was revealed, too. It's like the glass breaks and you see them moving and it's like, oh, shit, gravity.
Yeah, they don't even explain it. That's the thing that I kind of appreciated. They don't even explain it at all. You know, they don't say, there's no one at the beginning say, Yorktown has multiple gravitational fields, blah, blah, blah. You just need to look at it and then understand, and then they show the glass, and then that's it, you know? And that part is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But for me, a few too many contrivances there at the end, ultimately, I did enjoy the film.
For and me, it's the character moments, though, right? It's the thing like Spock's reveal about the necklace. And they're like, wait, so you gave your girlfriend a nuclear necklace? No, it's a tracking device. Uh-oh, beat. Like, that sort of thing. Like, the movie takes time to really reflect on these characters. They feel like people who've hung out together, who've worked together. And, yeah, not just the characters we've known for decades.
I really liked Anton Yelchin in the movie, too. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe I was paying more attention to him than I would have otherwise. But he's so, like, sort of sweet and enthusiastic and has this great, fun energy in the movie, and he has a lot of screen time because he's sort of the one who winds up with Kirk on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of got this gee whiz like boy scientist kind of vibe that's really I found very charming, and the fact that he's no longer with us I just thought was really sad because he was great. I really appreciated his sort of it's not the most important role, but that's kind of what the movie is about. It's like everyone is fun, everyone makes a contribution. I like all the main cast in these new Star Trek movies, but I thought he was really good in it. And there's that sad moment at the very end where they're having that toast at Kirk's birthday, and there's like they mention like they're toasting to whatever, and then they say to like to friends we've lost, and there's a cut to Anton Yelchin standing right there. I just thought it was really really sad.
Yeah, it was. Let's talk about formats. What format did you guys see this movie in? Just out of curiosity.
It was 2D fake IMAX.
Yeah, 2D IMAX.
I saw it in 3D real IMAX. And okay. I'll just say the 3D...
Which isn't quite real IMAX.
It's not. It's not. Yeah, there's no... They didn't shoot it on IMAX cameras.
How confusing all of this is.
Yeah, man. They did not shoot it on IMAX cameras or anything, as far as I know. Like, I don't think the screen expanded to fill the entire... You mm-hmm. know, the image didn't expand to fill the entire screen at any point. And the 3D, I thought, was mostly a waste. I don't think I perceived any cool effects from that. But the sound and visuals were really impressive on that large of a screen. I assume you guys also had a similar experience, yeah? Like the IMAX experience was worth it, in your opinion?
This is definitely a movie to see on a big screen, too. If only because Justin Lin really knows what he's doing with some of those shots. Like there was a brief glimpse we saw in the trailer of the Enterprise in hyperspace. And that is just like the most beautiful thing. Like, I'd love like an animated version of that on my wall. Something, because it looks incredible. The shot of like them getting out of Yorktown straight into space,
it's like a fixed camera really cool. shot, so like good. It's like I the camera's like shot. Mounted on the ship.
Yeah, that was a cool shot.
Yeah,
I really love the look of that, whatever that gas that turns into a solid is. It was cool the moment that Kirk and Chekhov are stuck in it. And then it can be shattered, and then that whole motorcycle sequence
of
springing around as a sort of shield. The idea of that was pretty cool.
Even though we saw it in 2D, like the shots in where they're swooping around Yorktown, on the big, you know, the fake IMAX screen, even it definitely you could feel like you were almost floating and spinning. There was definitely a moment or two where I was like, it felt a little almost vertiginous. You were like, you were getting a little, you felt like you were kind of swooping around and you were a little disoriented in a way that I maybe some people might get a little nauseous, but I thought it was pretty cool because it was like a sort of a visceral sense that you were in this weird high-tech space. It was like Tomorrowland if Tomorrowland didn't stink, I thought. Ooh, that was sort of the vibe.
Yeah. And there is like suspended water in Yorktown for some reason. Like they have these pools, but they have nothing underneath them.
Yeah, it's weird, okay?
Just some really crazy architectural decisions going on in Yorktown, but that looked pretty cool overall.
And those guys, they can throw together a new starship pretty quick. Those guys are just tossing together a starship like nothing. I imagine that it's kind of the same thing as building a an aircraft carrier to us, you know, which you think probably takes a long time and a lot of resources. These guys just throw together a starship. No biggie. No big whoop.
I like the almost small callbacks to other Justin Lin movies too. Like the heist way they had to plan the jail sequence felt a lot like Fast Five. The big, like, jump and catch my hand thing, which is very Fast 6.
Yeah, very Fast 6. Yeah, exactly. I do feel the need to point out something that happened in the movie that kind of made some news prior to the film's release, which is that it is revealed in this film that Sulu is gay and has a significant other who's a man, and they have a daughter together. And Matt, in your review, you wrote about how this is kind of a great little touch just because it humanizes Sulu in a way that makes Yorktown and its fate have stakes, and that other movies often forget this, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, just wanted to point that out as something that was an interesting development. We haven't mentioned it till now because I didn't want to spoil the film. I did find it interesting, what George Takei's comments were on it. Because he was not a huge fan of that decision, and I think it's because he had worked hard to create this character of Sulu who was not gay and wanted to kind of – would have preferred to see that character that he created honored. At the same time, I appreciate what they're trying to do in this new franchise as well.
And didn't I think Takei kind of referred more to Gene Roddenberry's vision?
Yeah, his vision.
Like, there are no labels. But at the same time, like that – was always a convenient excuse for like 60s television where you couldn't show certain things, and now you can actually show it and to reflect the real world where these things exist, and representation is important. I like that little scene, and it's amazing how there was such an uproar before it too, because people were like, what are you doing to my Star Trek? And it's just a nice little scene. That's all it is.
Yeah,
it's not a big culture war moment.
I thought, I respect completely what George Takei said, and I totally get where he's coming from. But, I think it's really great to have at least a character in that crew who's, another way to represent difference and diversity. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have minded if there was maybe a little more affection in that scene. It's a very brief scene. And, I think they were sort of I mean, who knows? I don't want to talk for the filmmakers. I've read a little bit of how they, you know, the thinking behind it in interviews with John Cho and Simon Pegg. And, you know, I think their intentions were good. You know, they didn't want to make it feel, I don't know, like they didn't want to maybe put too fine a point of it or make that much of a deal out of
right,
it. Like,
right.
In a way, it's just supposed to be totally normal, which it is. And I think that is, you know, I think that's great. I wouldn't have minded to see, you know, just a little bit, maybe a little bit more affection. It felt
perfunctory to you. Like,
well, it's a step in the right direction, mm-hmm. for sure. But it, you know, like for me, it could have been. They could have gone even just a little bit.
Just a kiss.
Here's
if
what I'll say.
If your significant other has been space for months, you probably kiss them. Yeah,
right.
And it would probably be more controversial if that had happened in this film.
Oh my god!
But here's what I'll say, guys. I think this is the only movie in the history of the 8 years that we've been doing the Slash Film Cast. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to make a statement and then be proven wrong. Is this the only movie where on screen there's two Asian males? Like not, I'm not even talking about the two in Sulu's relationship. There's him and his significant other and then another Asian male on the ship that you see earlier on that have romantic relationships.
Mm.
I think, I don't know that I've seen another film that has depicted that. That has been made in America, you know what I mean?
Right.
Versus like an Asian film, which obviously has a ton of Asian dudes in it. So I thought that was awesome. And
Justin Lin's secret conspiracy is working.
That's right.
It's working slowly.
That's right. I'll have to give him props at our weekly meeting about that. So anyway, the movie. I think Matt brings up a lot of great points, which is that the movie is in many ways. Thematically, and just like in terms of the cast and how that cast is deployed, a celebration of diversity in the face of lack thereof, and for that, I think, you know, I can salute the movie for that. So, but overall, I'm kind of on Jeff's side. Fun sci-fi action film. I wish it was more. For Matt Singer and Devendra, it sounds like it was more, and that's cool. But I would not feel bad recommending this movie to anyone. I think, it's definitely a fun time at the theater, and see it on a big screen with great sound. So, All right, I think that's going to bring us to the end of our review. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Matt Singer, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
I'm the editor-in-chief at screencrush.com. I'm writing there every single day. And my Twitter account is twitter.com/Matt Singer. And I do have my own podcast, Film Spotting SVU. And you can find that in iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And filmspottingsvu.com is our website.
All right. Jeff Cannata?
You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I have several other shows for you to check out, including a video game review show called DLC, which you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC. I have a tech video show called Tomorrow Daily on CNET. You can find that at tomorrowdaily.com. And a comedy science show called We Have Concerns, which you can find at wehaveconcerns.com.
How about you, Devendra?
Oh, I'm on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com.
And you can find all of my stuff at davechen.me. Thanks for listening to the Slash Filmcast this week. Next week, we'll be back with a review of Jason Bourne, which is a movie that Devendra and I are really looking forward to. Jeff, are you a Bourne fan?
Huge. Yeah, I love it. Can't wait.
We'll see if...
Time for my annual rewatch of the entire trilogy.
I think the question is whether this one is going to add anything new to the franchise or not. Matt Singer...
It's amazing it's taken so long, right? It's been almost 9 years since, or 10 years since Ultimatum. If only they'd made a Bourne movie since then.
Yeah.
this is a franchise that should be about punching stuff.
Totally.
I'm excited for punching.
50-year-old man punching muscular dudes.
Yeah, do it.
Matt Singer, you're a Bourne fan?
I mean, I really love the Bourne legacy. I'm just bummed we're not getting another movie about chems. No, I'm just kidding.
Get out of this podcast.
All right. Thanks, and we'll see you next week. We watch the movies, flicks, side tracks for the good, side bad. It's the Slash Filmcast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about. All right, guys. Slash Filmcast After Dark here, where we talk about just a variety of random stuff. I just wanted to mention one thing. that I saw recently, guys, and that is 99 Homes. Have you guys heard of this film with Michael Shannon and Andrew Garfield?
Ramin Barani movie.
Yeah, yeah, not a super great film, but Michael Shannon is awesome in it. He plays kind of a guy who's helping to repossess houses and flips them and, you know, does all kinds of sketchy things with them. But great Michael Shannon performance, and it's, of course, a movie that's very relevant in our post-housing bubble era. So I guess I just wanted to give a shout-out to that movie on the Slash Filmcast After Dark. Here's another movie I wanted to shout-out, guys. Hitman, Agent 47, movie I saw recently.
What are you doing right now?
Also not a great film, but it has some decent action scenes in it. And so if you
is
can...
Is that the one with Rupert Friend?
It is the one with Rupert Friend.
I like him. He's good in Homeland.
He's good in Homeland. I don't know why they keep trying to make Hitman happen as a franchise. Because...
And they keep like potentially ruining actors' careers by doing it too. Like, Oliphant?
The first one, yeah. And I don't know why, because Agent 47, he is supposed to be a character with no emotion or affect to him, which is great for a video. Like, video game main lead characters... are like often don't talk and don't have a lot of characteristics, so you as the player can project yourself into them.
He's the ideal avatar, literally a barcoded, you know, video game protagonist. So like he just comes off the manufacturing field. Have you guys played the new Hitman game?
I've heard it's good. Amazing. Jeff Cannata, you a Hitman fan?
I am not. I'm not a big fan of the Hitman games. I have played the first. They put out a demo before the new Hitman game came out, where you're infiltrating a cruise ship.
Yes.
I played through that. It's pretty cool. It's not my kind of game. I'm not huge into the stealth and I don't know. I don't like stealth games where, like, you know, if you mess up, you're start over kind of deal. Although the cool thing about Hitman is how many variety of ways you can accomplish the same goal, which is pretty clever.
Yeah. That is part of the fun. Like, it's a game of repetition, so you have to learn the patterns of everything. But yeah, I love the series, and this one definitely harkens more back to Hitman 2, where you just have this environment where you could do whatever the hell you want, and you can think of crazy things too. Like, it's episodic, so you have like a month with each episode and each environment to just like dig into it, which is a lot of fun.
And they have challenges for you to do it in a specific way, and it's almost like playing a horse with assassination.
So weird stuff too. Like, you can be a model in the first episode, like a runway model at some point, because there's a model in the episode who happens to look just like you. So, speaking of coincidences, but yeah, it's a pretty great series so far.
I think this is a movie that in some aspects is so bad it's good. There is a scene where Hitman Agent 47 walks into like an embassy with a sniper rifle, and then his interrogator, so then they, of course, they flag it at the metal detector and everything. his interrogator,
sir, what do you have there?
Metal detectors are working as intended.
His interrogator then brings the sniper rifle into the interrogation room with him.
Okay, yeah. That's also protocol, yeah.
And then, Agent 47, kind of taunts the interrogator. And then the interrogator, it gets so flustered, he puts a bullet into the sniper rifle. And then Agent 47, knocks up the table. And the sniper rifle goes up and then comes down on the table. And when it hits the table, it fires a bullet right through Agent 47's handcuffs. I mean, guys.
Nice. Good job, Agent 47.
That is so terrible. It is awesome.
Okay. Just as you planned.
This movie got an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes. Everyone hated it. And I don't think it's good, but I just don't understand why people hated it so much.
It scratches your itch.
It's a dumb action movie. You know, it's a dumb action movie that has like some semi decent action scenes in it, and is ridiculous, you know. And I guess I just feel like it got a bad rap. And on that note, you know, another dumb action movie that got a bad rap, guys? Transporter Refueled.
Dave,
I know. I'm really
know what to say
between
to you right
last
now.
Week trashing Ghostbusters Original and this week advocating for Agent 47 and Transporter Refueled. I saw the first
20 minutes of Refueled on the plane, and I had to turn it off. Even in a trapped environment where I was starved for entertainment, I just couldn't do it.
Transporter Field is not the worst transporter film. That's the thing.
Okay.
That's
well,
all I'm saying.
Is pretty bad.
That is all I'm saying.
It wouldn't be a big deal, Dave, if there weren't so many other things you don't watch.
Okay. That's true.
To be fair, guys, okay, I only – these are treadmill movies, right? Like, I watch them
you
when I'm
working
out. You
know what works well on a treadmill, Dave? TV shows.
Yeah.
Why
does a treadmill – what does a treadmill require you to watch garbage?
How long are your treadmill sessions? 42 minutes?
Because
something. TV episodes are exactly 42 minutes.
Well, I think the idea is I don't want to watch something I might enjoy while I'm physically subjecting myself to stress.
Why not? Doesn't that make the physical exertion less bad if you're enjoying it? It's like adding a difficult time to your already difficult time.
It's like seeing a movie in 4DX. You know,
you really have to embrace the self-flagellation.
When I'm on the freaking elliptical. Taking in new episodes of Orphan Black or something like that. No, I like watching mindless movies because I don't, you know, I don't want to think too hard when I'm working. I can't walk and chew gum at the same time, guys.
Okay,
I need to
I hear you. I hear you. You want to turn off while doing physically demanding.
That's right. That's exactly correct. Sure. So, anyway. That being said, you're right. I understand. I've completely discredited myself. And I'm okay.
There are so many things like Dave. Like just the Americans. Just start the Americans.
I have. I've gotten 6 episodes into the Americans. So
okay.
I've started that show.
Okay. You guys please watch Horace and Pete. Please.
It's more the access to it because I have to download it and stream it over to the TV, but I have Plex now, so that should be easier.
Guys. Summer movie wager interesting developments are afoot.
Oh, I've lost. I'm out. I've lost.
Okay, here. I don't know, Jeff. Here are the rankings right now. Peter's in the lead at 49 points. I'm at 42, primarily because I put Secret Life of Pets at number 3, which currently is the actual ranking of Secret Life of Pets.
Right.
For the summer, Jeff is dead last at 31.
Yeah. I'm out, guys. It's
Jermaine at 38.
I didn't even put Secret Life of Pets on my list like an idiot.
But Ghostbusters, that movie is going to really upend a lot of things, I think, when that plays itself out. Because we all had high hopes for Ghostbusters, at least some of us did. And so how it plays out, I think, is going to dramatically impact the rankings. But overall, we really won't know until movies like Bourne open. So, yeah. Anyway. I just wanted to give a shout out to that. Like, crazy things going on. You can find more at thesummermoviewager.com or find it on Twitter as well. There's an awesome listener who's giving commentary on our Summer Movie Wagers. You guys watch anything interesting this week?
Yeah. Have you guys been watching the new Unreal season?
Not yet.
I heard it kind of is a train wreck.
Unreal is a mess.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, there are so many things I still like about it, but they try to throw in... There is like escalated drama in every single episode, which I guess is key to like its themes and everything. I mean, the first season had a lot of problems too, but this one has different problems. It's still fascinating to watch, so I still recommend seeing it.
But yeah, I think Marty Noxon, one of the showrunners, left the series, is my understanding, and that has really hurt.
Former Buffy writer.
Yeah.
She's been known for a lot of things.
And just like a skilled showrunner, you know.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, she's run a bunch of shows. So that's probably what happened because they definitely go way overboard in certain things. But it's still worth watching, I'd say. And New Mr. Robot, I've only seen the first two premiere episodes, but it's still so good, so interesting. I know a lot of people have been down on it, but I kind of love the fact that you know, they're sticking to their strong creative vision. The creator of the show, Sam Esmail, is now directing every single episode of this season, which is a huge get for a guy who had never even like had a major TV show or run a show or written for a show before the first season of Mr. Robot. So I love that he has this amount of creative control now, for better or worse. Like, some of the visuals I think people will still have issues with, but it's a cool looking, really unique show for sure.
Yeah, I've heard it has gone downhill, but I got to admit, that was a show where I heard overwhelmingly critical acclaim for that show, and it's a show that I really feel like I got burned on. Like, I watched the whole season, and then by the end, I was like, that's it?
You did kind of binge it at the end, though, right?
I watched, you know, I wouldn't say I binged it, but, you know, I watched them within a relatively short period of time. I just felt like, I don't know, it just felt like a rather silly show to me. Yes. And just like the way that people talk is so stilted, which fits in with kind of the show's aesthetic, but I did not find the payoff to be satisfying. I like the twists. Like, those were kind of cool. There was a couple
definitely
twists at the end.
And
B.D. Wong is – B.D. Wong, right? Wong. Yeah, he's awesome, you know.
B.D. Wong's so great, yeah.
But I don't know. I felt like that's just a time where I'm like – I got to the end of it, and I was very disappointed by it. And but that being said, if you like it, you know.
Yeah. My big thing is we rarely see good interpretations of technology and hacking and, like, the idea, like, it may seem unrealistic, but everything you're seeing on screen is shit, like, they're actually coding and have had to do. And that's, like, Ben Samus Meal's big thing. There are no fake screens, you know, so they've had to code all this stuff.
I love that aspect of it, but I'm with you, Dave. I think I watched the first episode of Mr. Robot, and every episode after that, I liked it less.
Yeah.
I think that the first episode was so cool. I was like, oh my gosh, finally a show that actually treats technology with kind of intelligence and respect. And then every episode after that, I was like, oh, this is all we're doing. But oh well.
Yeah. It's just the tone of the show. I would just say it is relentless, you know?
Yeah. And it's a very specific tone too. So you have to be on its wavelength, and if you're not, I can see how it,
but yeah, I mean, I kept hoping it would get better. I kept hoping it would get better. And then by the end, it just was, I don't think it was bad. It just was like, it just was the same of what it was already delivering the entire time. And I would say if you're not on by like episode 3, you know, you probably won't be on. But I have heard that there's some interesting stuff that happens in the second season. I might dip in just like out of curiosity. So we'll see. Jeff, you've been checking out?
Yeah, I had a chance to watch the first episode of Vice Principals on HBO. Because, you know, guys, I have said it many times, I love me some Walton Goggins.
Oh, yeah. Especially he's silly Walton Goggins.
Yeah. I don't know about him in this show, though. this might be a Goggins too far. And I hate to say that because I'm such a fan of that guy. I think he's so, so good in everything. Gosh, I don't know. You know, I was never a big Eastbound and Down fan. And this – it really is Eastbound and Down in a different setting.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that going in. Like, I had just seen billboards of, three people that I think are amazing. It's Bill Murray and Walton Goggins and Danny McBride. I'm in. Oh, yeah, this is great. And I didn't realize it was Danny McBride, Jody Hill. And the show is Danny McBride. It's Danny McBride and –
and he has a shtick that he just like commits to, I think, in Eastbound and Down, and looks like here maybe.
Well, it's also that you just have to like be ready for a certain level of human ugliness when you watch.
Yeah,
because isn't it Jody Hill that did this, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So you have to be equipped to handle like a level of human ugliness that you aren't used to dealing with.
Yeah, and it's human ugliness with like actual teenagers now.
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
So
okay,
it can be kind of tough.
The ugliest of humans.
Yeah. Exactly. And what Goggins is doing, like the character the last moment of the first episode, I've only watched one episode so far. The last moment of the first episode made me go, okay, I'll give it another, at least one more, because it made me feel like maybe the show is taking a little bit of a turn. But what I was hoping for was this sort of ensemble comedy about these guys, and it isn't that at all. It's from the perspective of Danny McBride's character, all about Danny McBride's character, and everybody else is a minor character in the show. And that was a bit of a disappointment for me. But the end makes it seem like maybe that's not entirely the case, so hopefully I don't know. Well, I'll at least give it another episode.
All righty. Anything else going on this week that you guys want to discuss?
Well, Comic-Con's happening. Any fun news?
I think what's interesting at Comic-Con is like there are very few movie studios going to Comic-Con this year. A lot of movie studios feel like they've been burned by past Comic-Cons, where like I think the biggest examples are Kick-Ass and Scott Pilgrim. I think, right?
Matt Singer actually wrote up a whole report on that.
Like, yes,
basically correlating the Hall H presence versus, you know, how well the movie actually did.
Right. And do you know what the conclusion from that was?
It's not good. It's pretty bad. Yeah.
That so basically,
that's kind of why, we're seeing less of that.
Yeah. It just said, like, Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, it's the first year that you can actually stream stuff. I don't know. Are either of you guys interested in doing that? Are you, either of you guys subscribing to Comic-Con HQ?
Is it really? Yeah, I mean, I would like to. I guess, okay, like there is magic in the hall, right? Devinder, why are you so easily dismissing it? We had such a good time when we went, right?
Yeah. But you gave up sooner than us.
For sure. Like, for sure. I think just because
there's magic like the first couple times you go, and then it's just like, oh, lines. You live in the lines.
It's true.
Jeff, are you streaming any Hall H stuff?
I haven't, but I'm hoping to some today and tomorrow. I mean, really, the coolest stuff hasn't really happened yet as we record. So I'm hoping to be able to watch some of the Marvel panel or something. I think it'd be fun, but I don't know.
Don't you usually go to Comic-Con to do, like, is there a reason you didn't go this year? Are you going this year? Like, you're not, right?
I'm not going this year. I usually do go. I'll be completely honest with you. I'm a little glad not to be going this year. Like Devinder was saying, it has gotten so big and so tumultuous that it's just like, it's just a throng of people everywhere, and it makes it very difficult to do anything. And since I didn't have any actual necessity to be there, I didn't go this year. But you know, there's part of my soul that's a little sad that I'm not there, because all my friends are there, and you hear about great fun things. But it is a very exhausting, and it's exhausting not just being there, but planning to be there is exhausting. The lottery to get hotel rooms, and the all the mishigas of getting your passes, and it's just that they make it very unfriendly to everyone, not just press, but everyone, to even sort of negotiate the difficulty, the logistics of being there. And for many years, they talked about moving it up here to Los Angeles, because Los Angeles has so much more room and infrastructure built, you know, to handle that kind of thing. I think that would be a sad thing, because I think Comic-Con and San Diego are just sort of inextricably linked in my head. But I kind of feel like something has to be done, because it has become too big for its own good, I think.
Yeah. I mean, any desire to do like a We Have Concerns panel or something like that? Like, was that?
Yeah,
ever
I mean, for
floated?
Years we did Totally Rad Show panels, and they were extremely fun and just a blast. And yeah, I mean,
I'm the only one that remembers the Beatles.
Hello, I'm Guy Garvey. Richard Curtis and Danny Boyle have joined forces for Yesterday. We got them together to talk filmmaking.
I always saw Trainspotting just as the Northern Four Weddings.
Music.
These songs were part of us.
And a world without the Beatles.
A world without the Beatles would be infinitely worse.
The Yesterday podcast, available from wherever you get your podcasts.
Yesterday. When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?